From Utah Public Radio, this is Undisciplined. I'm Matthew LaPlante. About a year ago, I received an email from the Annenberg Center for Climate Journalism and Communication at the University of Southern California. And it was a request to take a quick survey that was also being sent to other climate communicators, an attempt to get a temperature check on how climate information moves across the research and media landscape. And the canned language on this email was great. It said, "Our center considers you to be one of the most impactful climate storytellers today," which, you know, is just not true. But it massaged my ego just enough that I clicked into the survey and filled it out. And then I promptly forgot about it. Until I got an email recently that said, hey, the survey is out. And the findings, well, they're pretty fascinating in no small part because, as the center's director, Allison Agston, points out, climate journalism and climate communications are still really nascent professional fields. They've really only emerged in the last few decades. And while there are some relatively new climate communication research centers at universities like George Mason and Yale and the University of Colorado at Boulder, those centers mostly look at how climate communication impacts public perception of climate science. What Agston and her team wanted to find out is how they can best support the communicators themselves. Thus, the survey that I and 1,000 other people, who presumably are the other most impactful climate storytellers today, received. The report paints a picture of a communications community that is a bit fractured, not by acceptance of climate science, that much we all pretty much agree on, but by how we get information, the challenges we face in communicating that information, and our perceptions about the biggest obstacles in front of us. Allison Agston is the inaugural director of the USC Annenberg Center for Climate Journalism and Communication. Allison, welcome.
Well, thank you for having me, Matthew.
Allison, I find your trajectory so interesting. You were a producer at CNN, often focused on arts coverage. This was back in the early 2000s. It was a really interesting time at CNN. The network was arguably at the height of its importance, but audiences were starting to drift online and seek out other non-traditional news sources. And there was a big round of layoffs at CNN at that time. News media providers were sort of struggling to figure out how to compete in that space at that time. That must have been really fascinating to watch that from the inside.
Yeah, it was. And as you say it, you could be talking about the media landscape right now. You could be talking about CNN struggles and cable news struggles at this moment, even just watching what's happening with newspapers in the past couple of years has been pretty shocking. Needless to say, in the past couple of decades, the tumult in media hasn't exactly quieted.
It hasn't, but on the other hand, also, we're still here. We're still alive. We're like CNN's still here. Public radio is still here. There are a lot of newspapers still out there. My students still get jobs in newspapers. So, like, what was it, like, the thing that Mark Twain said? Like, rumors of my death have been greatly exaggerated. Like,
yes.
Maybe we're okay. I don't know.
I hope so. Fingers crossed. Fingers crossed, Matthew.
You stayed in the arts for a long time. You worked for the LA County Museum, the Hammer Museum, among other positions. But then this thing happened to you. It's like this huge right turn. Maybe you don't see it. Maybe you see it as like a curve turn. But like, it seems like this really interesting and dynamic career turn toward environment and climate. What happened?
Yeah, you know, I think like some of the big twists and turns that happened in other careers, it was accidental. I was working on a project I absolutely loved in my heart and soul with a real estate developer who wanted to start a new museum focused on LA art in downtown Los Angeles. The funding dried up and I was absolutely shocked and utterly devastated. And as I walked away from that project, I had the opportunity to really think about what I could do with the sum of my career so far to advance the ideas that were important to me. And something that I realized working downtown, as I had for a few years on this project, was that the art community there that was, as far as the outside world was concerned, it was really thriving. And there's a story in, you know, every international publication once a month about LA as this new art capital of the world. But what I had observed through a project I did a few years in a row called office hours. What office hours was is I would book a month out of my calendar and I meet with the first 50 artists in downtown area who signed up, and I'd spend an hour with each one. And when I was done, we'd hang painting or, you know, drawing, whatever they brought in. And then once that was done, we'd have a big community opening. And it was really, really special because people who never had spoken to a curator before, had access to a museum space, had their work hung anywhere, maybe some of them never even shown their artwork to anybody, were coming in and meeting with me. And it was kind of like an hour of therapy in a way. I got to learn what was going on with people. And after a few years, I realized that artists were not just struggling to keep their heads above water and pay rent, but they were increasingly becoming homeless or on the brink in downtown Los Angeles. And so I was fortunate enough to get a fellowship with Arts for LA, a local arts organization, to study lack of affordability for arts in Los Angeles. Because my thing is, you can't run around saying that this is one of the great arts capitals of the world as, you know, city leaders, if we can't actually support artists.
So you started to get this bug for communities in need and this mission-driven thing, which I don't want to like understate like the importance of the mission-driven impulses that I'm sure guided your desire to share the arts world with people. But there was this thing that you said, like, I'd like to start transitioning my life toward something that brings me hope, brings me purpose.
I was seeing something percolating that I was really, really concerned about. And I was afraid that other people might not be seeing it. And I had to do everything I can to be sure that this issue was seen. So I went back to policy school to do a mid-career master's degree, imagining I was going to study cultural policy. But before I even went to my first class, I went to a lecture that was delivered by a woman who was a co-founder of the Arctic Initiative at the Harvard Kennedy School. And she began by asking everybody what came to mind when they thought of climate change. And 100% of people said icebergs or polar bears. And, you know, it's not wrong. However, it's the most, perhaps what it feels like, the most cinematic moment in my life, because it was in that moment that I went, oh my God, climate change is a visual problem. Wait a second, I think we might have been like misvisualizing this greatest issue of our time. Of course, people aren't going to respond if they, you know, if they see that there's issues going on in this vast snowy expanse where nobody lives and there's a couple of polar bears and they're sick, but it's not like really your problem if it's that far away. And from literally that moment on, that's all I did was focus on climate change, how it is communicated, how it is visualized, and became also just totally obsessed with the Arctic. I still am.
All right. Now, what I really love about the story, too, is like as somebody who gives a lot of climate lectures, like I am no Hala Logadorder, who's the person who's right. Like who's the person who gave that lecture that changed your life. But the idea that there might be somebody sitting in a classroom somewhere who like is like inspired and has this idea and connects it to their life, which is what a lecture is, which is what education is. It's not imparting information. It's giving people the ability to make connections, which is what you do. You make this connection, and now here you are. And I think there's this really interesting tie-in. Like, then as an arts communicator, now as a climate communicator, your job is really fighting to make challenging and nuanced things accessible and relevant to people.
Oh, you hit the nail on the head. That's exactly what it is. It's just doing a different form of interpretive work.
So to do that interpretive work, you need to understand the lay of the land, how climate is being communicated currently, how communicators and potential communicators are getting their information and what they feel their challenges are. And so your team puts together this report called Temperature Check. And I mentioned the words temperature check in my introduction because that was actually the term that was in the solicitory email. Like you wanted to get, I mean, a lot of people say snapshot, right? But temperature check kind of works, right? Like as a metaphor here. Was this the thing that when you came in, because you're still relatively new, a couple of years in. So was this sort of your first big initiative as director?
No, there's been some other big things. They've all taken different forms. I'd say probably the first biggest thing I did was train a group of ABC journalists who were working at the 8 owned and operated stations across the country, which ends up reaching about a quarter of the U.S. population. We worked with them.
This is that group of 25 journalists that's mentioned in the report, yeah?
Yes.
Yeah.
We helped them learn how to incorporate climate into their reporting. And in fact, we were astonished and delighted to see that in the 6 months after the training, the amount of climate coverage they produced doubled the 6 months previous. And so now we're working on a study to see like, okay, that's great. There was more coverage, but how did it resonate with people or make a difference? So there were some other things, but I think this is definitely like maybe the biggest initiative reaching out to the community, to our public, to our climate people, if you will.
And this report, it lays out a lot of these challenges and a lot of the findings I think are pretty sensical, but I was wondering if there was something that really jumped out at you that was counterintuitive or otherwise surprising, like an aha moment as you're pouring through the data.
Yeah, there were a couple of things. I think above all, I was surprised that for climate communicators, they felt their greatest challenge was the complexity of the issue. So on one level, that totally makes sense because climate change is deeply complicated. And like anything else, the more I know, the more I realize I need to learn and to know. But I guess I also expected that these people, that this particular group would feel pretty at ease with their understanding of the topic. But I do think this is a really big hurdle that we need to think about more carefully, because I also survey everybody who goes in and out of one of my training programs, whether that is a journalist, or I also train external and internal groups of climate experts. So like, for example, our USC faculty, you know, ranging from geologists to psychologists, you know, landscape architects, if your work is intersecting with climate some way, and you want to learn how to do that work better, then come see me and go through a half day intensive. And what I found in the surveys that I give the journalists whom I work with and the scientists, let's say, for shorthand, that I work with, is that they both have the same, there's the same reason that both of those groups are not communicating as much about climate as I personally wish they would. And it's that they're afraid they don't know how to do it. So for journalists, they're concerned, maybe they have a humanities or social sciences background, they're concerned that they don't have a full grasp of the complexity of this issue. For scientists, they have spent maybe decades, you know, very narrowly focused on a certain topic, and communication is not really part of the job description. And so I'm really interested in thinking more about what I can do, what kind of supports I can provide for people of all kinds who do want to talk about the issue. We know how important it is to socialize and normalize climate conversations. How can I help people feel like, look, you don't have to know absolutely everything. You know, you can be a journalist without a science background and you can still weave climate in to your conversations.
This complexity thing is tough though, right? Because the conundrum is, the truth is, and I say this as a climate scientist, climate is complex. It's really complex. It's physics and computer science and machine learning and chaos theory. And as the host of a show where I interview different scientists all of the time, all science is really complex. And so there is this fear that like, man, I'm not going to get the nuance right. I'm not going to get the exact data right. And I do also hear that from both journalists and scientists, that they're really afraid that if they make a pronouncement and it's wrong, it's going to undercut their credibility and the credibility of the movement.
You said it, and I have such empathy for that. I guess, you know, I always put myself forth to people like, I'm scared too. I don't want to come on your podcast and say something that is wrong and broadcast it out into the world and perpetuate misperceptions or frankly just look like an ass. That's the last thing I want. And sometimes I get scared too. There's sometimes I'm interviewed for something and I will feel really uncomfortable, but I call upon my past experiences doing new things and being uncomfortable and sometimes messing up, but usually it ends up okay. And that helps me to put one foot in front of the other and just keep doing it. And I always remind people, like, if a journalist/curator can do this, I assure you, you can too.
You also, in this report, have noted that there is a pretty pronounced lack of climate coverage in local media. Larger news organizations are, by virtue often of being better funded, are able to adjust and add these beats, and smaller ones are still struggling. But smaller local news organizations are still where a lot of people get their news and where a lot of the trust that remains in the news media still is.
Yeah, you said it. That one was a tough pill to swallow for us when we were analyzing the data, because we know that stories about the places where people live that relate to their real lives are the ones that have the most resonance. So I can read a major national newspaper talking about, let's say, wildfires in Canada, but I might be able to relate more to a story about drought in Los Angeles because it relates to me personally. So the local news landscape is incredibly important. I was also interested to see from our respondents that, like, they're not getting their news from any of those local news sources. And I want to know more about that. Like, is that because there is not enough of that journalism that exists? Do people not trust their local news sources as much as, you know, we think they do?
For these big, complex issues, perhaps, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yes, I think that that could definitely be part of it. We're chewing on that one still a little bit.
One of the things I found interesting, there's a section in the report where your survey respondents talk about who inspires them. And it's people like Bill McKibben, whose book is called The End of Nature, and David Wallace Wells, who famously wrote that whatever you might think of climate change, it's actually much worse, and Elizabeth Colbert, who wrote The Sixth Extinction. And these are important experts. These are brilliant people, people I admire. But also, man, a lot of the messages that our messengers are getting from other climate messengers are really dire and really scary and really sad.
Oh, I know. I thought that section, I had no idea what we were going to get with that section. But when I think about it, those are like the big names. Those are the names that people remember. I would love to see a much more diverse list, get people out there with different perspectives. I'd love to see people with more solutions-oriented approaches in that list, and it'll be interesting to see if we ask that question again in 5 years, how it all shifts. Because the idea is that we'll keep doing this every year. We just sent out this week our second survey for our second temperature check, and we have some new questions on there. I think we left that question out this year. We didn't imagine that we could gain much new insight within a year on who is really influencing people in this space. We did this time spend a little bit more of a focus on AI and on the election, since that's what we are hearing is on people's minds.
You know, a lot of what we think of in terms of diversity of voices is climate believers versus climate deniers, but the vast, vast majority of people on our planet understand at a basic level that our atmosphere and oceans are warming as a result of human-emitted greenhouse gases. And so I think, like, a better way of thinking about this diversity, and it sounds like what you're thinking about moving forward, is climate optimists versus climate pessimists, right? And I do think, like, there is a growing number of people who really identify as climate optimists. There were some indications of this sort of shift in your report. One was represented in a quote from Travis Niles, who's a marketing manager for the conservation think tank RARE. He told your team that engaging with diverse climate media has helped change the narrative from, oh my God, sacrifice to save the world, to get excited for the better products that are coming that will make your life better and also save the world. And I read that and I was like, I want this guy on my show. I love him already.
those open-ended responses, you know, when you're doing a survey, it's always like, how many questions, how far can you push until people are like, basta, stop with this survey. And I don't want to, you know, no more. Give me a yes or no question. I don't want to fill in the blanks. But without a doubt, the most interesting part of the survey to me, or maybe just like the most satisfying, was reading the remarks of people like Travis. Like, I love that. I love that quote so many. There were so many great ones in there that added life to the data and reminded me that it's not just that, you know, this job is emotional for a lot of us. We really care about it. And you could get a sense for the feeling and the lives behind some of the people who were clicking through.
There is a chart on page 11 of this report that really fascinated me, because the difference in perception of what the biggest challenges facing climate communicators are was pretty stark. And there could be some sample size issues at play here, I don't know, but everybody, journalists, researchers, climate activists, PR professionals, everybody said complexity was the hardest obstacle to get around. But then a quarter of journalists said the biggest challenge they were facing, or that one of the biggest challenges they were facing beyond complexity, is apathy. None of the PR professionals said that. And the other groups, it was like about 10%. It was a much smaller number. The journalists are really feeling this right now. What do you make of that?
I think it's extraordinarily hard to spend your day in and day out trying to tell people to pay attention to this, and then the response isn't what you hope. People don't care. They don't make the changes they should. The election doesn't turn out as you want. You know, I think there has got to be just like a sense of vulnerability of going to work every day, sounding the alarm. People are maybe not, like I said, making those changes, and maybe your job could still be on the line on top of it.
Hey, are there other challenges for climate communicators that revealed themselves in the process of collecting and analyzing all this data?
I will say something that's happened, I would say a few months after we deployed the survey, is that every call and email I had, every conversation with anybody I had, from a journalist to somebody from the State Department to somebody at the UN, were all about AI and disinformation. So you'll see some of that in this next survey. I have gone to a number of conferences, sat in a number of sessions where this is a big part of the discussion. And I think nobody knows what to do. And at this point, it's a lot of admiring the problem and wringing hands, which is not necessarily useful. But since that's something that I kind of picked up on, I am working to develop a couple of programs that anybody can sign up for, you know, like a half day intensive to get your arms around AI and climate communications and journalism, how to use them, what to watch out for, the ethics behind it, that sort of thing, because those are the questions that people keep asking.
There are a lot of challenges ahead of you. You learn about more every day as you get deeper and deeper into this area. But you still sound pretty jonesed and excited about it. Like, you're stoked to be in this fight.
Well, I think that's partly just my disposition. I think that's just sort of how I am as a person. But I could look at this as just like, well, I think maybe for the first couple of days after the election, I was like, what am I doing with my life? Like, obviously, nobody wants this. And then I was like, wait a second. People want this. The work is more important than ever. I am sincerely excited to make connections with people who maybe I wasn't talking to before, who are conservative legislators or even more conservative folks in the community who want to know more about climate change. I am here and ready to avail myself to help people understand why it's an issue, what we can do. I think that this is kind of the only way forward is, how can we how can we work together on this? And a new Trump administration is going to present certainly new opportunities to think about that. And hopefully there will be some opportunities along the way to work on it with other folks.
That's Allison Agaston. She is the inaugural director of USC Annenberg's Center for Climate Journalism and Communication. Allison, thank you.
Matthew, thank you. You are a podcaster extraordinaire.
Thanks so much. Undisciplined is a production of Utah Public Radio. And if you happen to live in Utah, you can listen to us on UPR every Thursday morning at 10:30. If you miss us then, you can listen to every episode of Undisciplined wherever you get your podcasts. Our program is supported by the College of Humanities and Social Sciences at Utah State University. And importantly, folks, from listeners like you, you can support our work at donate.nprstations.org/UPR. Our producer is Reagan Edelman. Our theme music is Little Idea by Benjamin Tissot. And I'm Matthew LaPlante. Thanks for listening. Now go have big ideas.